This podcast is not intended as a substitute for proper diagnosis and medical care by a qualified veterinarian. Furthermore, the views expressed in this podcast are those of our hospital only and are not intended to represent the policies and practices of other animal hospitals. Welcome to the Animal Hospital of North Asheville podcast. I'm your host, Gretchen Harwell, and joining me again for her 1,000,000th episode is Dr. Plankenhorn. Thank you for joining me again, Dr. P.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Thank you. And we are going to talk today about pain, and largely we're going to talk about chronic pain. But I want to start by, everybody kind of has a sense of what pain is. It's when stuff hurts. But let's talk about, you know, as we understand pain in the veterinary world, there's kind of three types of pain.
Yes.
So there's acute, there's chronic, and there's maladaptive pain. And that's kind of a newer understanding of pain, you know, in the grand scheme of things. It used to be just acute and chronic pain. And now we also have what we call maladaptive pain. Can you briefly explain the differences between those things and what they each are?
So acute pain is the pain that occurs after a trauma, a surgery, you know, any kind of tissue damage, and it's the body's appropriate response to, you know, anything harmful or traumatic. And, you know, that's, you need that. It keeps you from getting into more trouble. But it's, you know, it's, this is a normal type of pain. Chronic pain is defined as pain that is due to an ongoing problem, so that doesn't necessarily get better. So arthritis is, of course, the most obvious example of that.
Right.
Because you're not solving the arthritis, you're just solving the pain response to the arthritis, and that's something that's not going to go away. So, you know, we just try to minimize the pain that's related to that. Maladaptive pain is kind of a newer term, and it is defined as pain that continues after the cause of pain is gone. So amputation, for example, is a source of maladaptive pain. Sometimes after, you know, some nerve pains, for example, if there's, you know, after the actual injury has been solved, there's just continued pain that that your body is producing for no apparent reason. So
right, exactly. And sometimes, like they used to recall in the instance that you gave about amputation, they used to sometimes call that phantom pain.
Right.
Because those nerve endings are still firing from whatever injury resulted in the amputation.
Exactly.
And so sometimes that is, you know, that would be an instance of maladaptive pain because your body didn't stop sending those pain signals.
Mm-hmm. And cats, for example, have hypersensitivity syndromes where they, which we don't fully understand if they're behavioral or if they're, you know, truly pain, but, you know, they may just randomly have just like start screaming and chewing on their back end or chewing on their tail, sometimes to the point of self-mutilation.
Right.
Because it's just so intense, and it's not an active process, and we don't understand a lot of it.
Right.
Just even in human medicine, where we have patients that can talk, there's still a lot that's being learned about.
Exactly. And also, I've seen, I mean, you mentioned cats, also in dogs, I used to work for a board-certified surgeon way back in the early days.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of cervical disc surgeries. And a lot of cervical disc dogs end up, some people call it like hyperesthesia, because even if you reach for the dog, you haven't even touched it yet, they feel pain.
Yeah.
And they're screaming in pain because you're reaching for them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is before, pardon me, listeners, if you can hear my dogs barking in the background. They're supposed to be locked up. Anyway.
But it's a vet podcast,
exactly.
So, you know.
What is a vet
podcast? You're partly like animals.
What's a vet podcast without dogs and cats? So, anyway, they do feel genuine pain, and without there being any true stimulus,
mm-hmm.
it's all perceived.
Yeah.
But but it's pain all the same. And so you still have to treat it. And there are, you know, you can go down a rabbit hole about maladaptive pain and the various kinds of treatment. We're not doing that.
No.
We're going to talk about chronic pain.
Let's do.
Okay. So you mentioned arthritis as one of the primary causes that we talk about, we see it the most, of chronic pain. Yeah. Are there a couple others?
Cancer, mm-hmm. unfortunately, is mm-hmm. a source of pain, particularly bone cancers and some of the, and that can be a tremendous source of pain. What else? Mouth pain, bad teeth.
Yes.
Eye pain is another thing. Glaucoma can cause chronic pain.
Yep.
A lot of ear problems. I mean, anything that can cause damage to the tissues.
Right.
Back problems. I mean, a lot of people have bad backs, so do a lot of animals.
Yes. And to your point also, any chronic condition can cause chronic pain.
True.
Chronic allergies can cause chronic ear infections, which can cause chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
And also even some of the acute conditions, like you might have an acute pancreatitis. Well, that pet might be sensitive in its belly for quite a while. It's not really going to turn into chronic pain the same way, but picking up that pet for quite a while after the the other symptoms have resolved, they might still be painful for a bit.
And I mean, terminology-wise, is that maladaptive pain
or
is it chronic pain?
Yes.
You know, it's picking nits just a little bit, you know, but basically, you know, thinking about managing chronic pain, it's really trying to... you know, if we can correct the problem, like pull bad teeth, for example,
right,
or treat ear infections or whatever,
treat the allergies,
then we can deal with that. But some things we can't fix, you know, we can't fix arthritis.
As much as, boy, we would be billionaires if we could.
I mean, nice. Yes. You know, other chronic conditions in the back or the neck, you know, or arthritic changes there.
Right. And I mean, like, you know, you can amputate a limb that has bone cancer.
Yeah.
But you can't cure that cancer so much.
Right.
As, you know, hopefully just alleviate the symptoms of it. And we've already talked about that in our chemotherapy discussion and our cancer discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we basically just touched on this. Disease processes that also contribute to a pet's pain. I mean, like, does diabetes cause pain?
No, not really.
Not really. I do think that there are times where they have a general sense of unease because their endocrine system is out of whack, but it's not necessarily painful. They just feel weirded out.
They're just thirsty and thirsty and thirsty, and their electrolytes are out of whack. And in some cats, we can see actually reversible neurologic damage where they start walking down on the base of their heels. But it doesn't seem to be a painful condition.
Right, no. And I mean, we already talked about cancer. Of course, that and many of its treatments can cause you to feel pretty crummy.
Yeah.
And we talked about arthritis. I mean, other chronic conditions. I mean, Cushing's, Addison's.
Again, those don't tend to be...
They don't tend to be painful.
They don't tend to be painful. So.
They might travel in the same car as arthritis.
Yeah.
At times, if you know...
But it may just be the same patient.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. So, you know, the pet might also have arthritis, and it's not the Cushing's causing the pain, it's the arthritis.
Right. I have a patient right now that we're treating for lymphoma, lymphatic cancer, and he's an older dog, and so he has some arthritis. And so we're trying to balance his pain management and his cancer management safely without creating any side effects or, you know, bad drug interactions or anything. So... You know, we try to take a really holistic view of the whole animal.
Right, yeah. How do you treat one thing without making the other thing much worse?
Yeah.
Yep.
Which is, you know, nice to be in general practice so we can not have all these subspecialists that are, you know, well, my pain specialist says to do this, but my general practitioner says to do this, my internist says to do that.
Right.
And, you know.
Yes, and my licensed nutritionist said, whatever you do, don't take all those things.
So. Yeah.
Yes. And now, what about, you know, there are times where chronic pain seems to wax and wane sometimes in some pets. Some patients are never painful and some patients are always painful. But what are some things or situations that can trigger this or trigger a painful period, like a spell.
Yeah. Well, like the description of, say, a dog with arthritis is when he first gets up in the morning, he's really stiff. He has trouble getting up. You know, if he has to do stairs, he may have difficulty with the stairs. And then once he starts moving around and things kind of warm up and they loosen up a little bit, and the juices are flowing, then he does better and he's more functional.
Mm-hmm.
But then he lies down and has his afternoon nap, and then he's creaky and stiff when he gets up again. So that's a really common scenario of just, you know, is it something that they warm out of, as we talk about, or is it all the time that they have trouble?
Right.
I also see dogs who are doing okay. You know, they're maintaining, they're comfortable, you know, things are okay. And then they go to the dog park, or they have a buddy come over, or they've gotten together for the holidays.
They saw a squirrel.
They're playing with another dog and going crazy, and their brain says, I can do this. And their body says, oh no, you can't. And so they come in and see me the next day because they've got a pulled muscle, or they're really limping, or they're, you know, suddenly they're in acute pain, but it's exacerbated by a chronic condition.
Yes. I had a dog with shoulder arthritis. She had little teeny short legs, and our neighbor had a rabbit. She would try her best to dig under the fence to go visit Marshall, and she would limp for days after that because, you know, a little dog with little legs and shoulder arthritis should not be digging holes.
Yeah.
And, you know, tell her that all day long. She didn't care. She was going to try to go get the rabbit.
Yeah.
And that's what that was.
So, again, you know, you get into semantics. Is this acute pain on top of chronic pain?
Right.
Maybe so. You know, if it's an injury on top of whatever, but... You know, if the body is already sensitized by the by the presence of pain and inflammation anyway, then it's going to tend to take a lot less trauma.
And we're talking about it waxing and waning. And so sometimes that stuff is what causes it to wax.
Yeah.
And then, okay, and what about, you know, cold weather?
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, I'm creaky and sore when it's cold. You know,
I'm always creaky and sore, but that's another story.
Yeah. No, but it's true. You know, when it's cold out, you're shivering more, everything's firing more, you know, all that stuff. It's going, you just want to bundle up and be warm. And if you bundle up and stay warm for too long, well, then you've sat for too long.
Yeah.
And there you are, you know, you gotta work your way out of it again.
Well, in the American Animal Hospital Association pain management guidelines, they actually talk about how cold is good for acute injuries.
Right.
And warm is good for chronic injuries.
Right.
So, I mean, if you think about it just really simplistically like that, yeah, I mean, chronic pain and chronic arthritis or whatever is more responsive to warming.
Yes, exactly. And that's, you know, like back in another lifetime, I was a musician and I was a clarinetist, and I would play, and I would warm up my wrists with warm water before I played, and then cold water after. And it, you know, loosen things up, get things moving before you're going to give your little fingers a workout there.
Yep.
And then cool them down and let it rest afterward. And that was, you know, that was as recommended by my doctor. Yep. So, and now, how do veterinarians treat pain? That's a really broad question, but really what I mean is there like an old school approach versus a more modern approach? Because, you know, it used to be like all the drugs that would give you a GI bleed, that's what we had.
Yeah. Well, way back in the 20th century, when I was in school and coming out of it, back in the 80s, we didn't understand pain as well as we do now, for one thing, just scientifically. We didn't have a whole lot of options for pain management in terms of having safe options to be able to do things. And like post-operative recovery, the mindset was, well, pain is a good thing because then they're not going to be as active. They're just going to be still. And this is actually beneficial to their recovery.
Right, it was inhibitory pain.
Yeah, that is super old school.
Yes.
So, really, in the last 20 25 years, a lot more research has been done about pain management in animals. And part of our challenge is that they cannot verbally say, ouch, you know.
Or that's not helping.
Yeah, or whatever. Their evolutionarily, they're not supposed to show pain or weakness because that makes them prey.
Exactly. You know,
that makes them really vulnerable.
Yes.
So they're very good at hiding pain.
Yes.
And, you know, evolutionarily, maybe a little toy poodle might be a bit more willing to express pain.
Yes.
More vocally than, say, an Irish wolfhound. But that doesn't mean that the Irish wolfhound doesn't feel pain.
Right, they're just more stoic.
They just don't tell us about it.
Right.
And, that creates a real challenge in terms of evaluating, you know, what are they feeling?
Yes.
And you know, how much pain are they in? And, I mean, even now, in the beautiful 21st century,
we
still have trouble with that.
Yes, and not only do we, but we are still figuring out what works and what doesn't work. For example, back in the day, when I first started with that surgeon, I started there in, 04 or 05, and it was when they were hyping tramadol to everybody for everything. They're saying, oh, use tramadol with this and use tramadol with that. And now they're saying, like, whoops, well, it turns out tramadol does not work for pain in dogs.
Right.
It works as a mild sedative.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they thought, they were getting good pain control because the dogs were drowsy.
Yeah.
And also constipated.
A little bit sometimes.
And so, and, you know, I mean, and that was the thing, is like they thought it was working because the dogs were mildly sedated.
Yeah.
And it turns out it wasn't doing a darn thing for their pain. I even had a vet in a lecture say, if you want to use tramadol for pain, throw it at the dog's head because you will at least distract them from their pain. But there are people who still hang on to that. And it's just like, no, there are newer, much better drugs out there. And that's something that we've learned in the last, 16 years.
Yeah.
So
the other thing that can happen is, with people, there's a placebo effect, right?
Right.
You know, you can take a sugar pill, and if you think you're taking something beneficial, then your mind says this is better.
Hey, it worked.
So technically, we don't really have that placebo effect in dogs and cats because cats think it's poison no matter what you're giving to them.
Yes. Even if it's their food.
And dogs think it's a treat no matter what you're giving to them, usually.
Yes.
So they don't know that they're supposed to feel better. But I think sometimes owners have a placebo
effect.
They have
a perceived,
and perceived benefit or lack thereof with their animals, because they want it. They want them to be better.
They want to make them feel better. They want to know the thing they did helped.
And we do too.
Yeah.
You know?
I would love to be able to just wave my hands over every dog and say, you're cured.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I'm not that kind of doctor, by the way.
I haven't gotten that degree yet. Exactly.
So we have to, there's several different organizations and universities and such have devised pain scales to be able to evaluate a little bit more objectively.
Excuse me. Yeah. Well, it's always going to be a teeny bit subjective because it's a human looking at a patient.
Sure.
But yeah.
And we use this in the hospital. And if we have a patient in the hospital, we're doing pain assessments on them multiple times a day.
And
using this pain scale is a veterinary specific pain scale, species specific pain scale, because the way cats demonstrate pain is way different than the way dogs demonstrate pain.
Exactly. And I took some years off in the middle of my career. I started at the animal hospital in 07, and then I took some years off when I had my child and I came back. And actually, the way we assess cat pain changed in those years off. And now we use a grimace score.
Yeah.
And there is actually, I attended a bunch of lectures this past spring on pain and pain management. And there is a horse grimace scale. There's a rat grimace scale. There's a cat grimace scale. There's all of these animals, basically from the set of their eyebrows, the way they hold their ears, what their general posture is, the way they hold their whiskers.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, I mean, I think it's hilarious. It also would make a great band name. Rat grimace scale.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but all of these animals, it seems terrible because you were like, were they inflicting pain on these patients and then looking at their facial expressions, or were they taking patients, how did they develop this? But they took patients that were already sick, and they said, How does he look? And then if we give him this thing, how does it look now?
Yeah.
And, you know, they've developed a lot in just a short period of time.
Absolutely. And even going down the road of cats, you know, if I have a patient in the hospital and they're sitting, you know, piled up in the corner mm-hmm. and they're just crouching and they're looking at me and their eyes are wide and they're, you know, is that fear or is that pain?
Right.
And if a cat goes from that to relaxed and curling up in a cat ball, you know, or stretched out or whatever, that is a cat that's comfortable.
Right. And if you can assess that without having to reach in and stress out the possibly already fearful cat,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't have to stick a stethoscope on them or take their temperature or any of those things, you can just look at their face and their posture and say, okay, let's make the cage warm and cozy and see what happens.
Yeah.
And then you can sort of judge for yourself which mm-hmm. one it was.
Or give them whatever pain drugs that we're giving to them. Or
try a little something and see if it helps.
Yeah. And that's something, you know, kind of for the utility of our listeners, you know, that if you observe your pet and kind of know what their normal behavior is,
which most of us know that. Right.
You know, how are they relaxed? You know, a lot of times when I'm talking to people about, again, especially with cats, mm-hmm. because they're so good at hiding it.
Yes.
You know, is he sleeping?
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, sleeping is important. That's a huge part of a cat's day. You know, if the cat's not sleeping and they're just sitting there hunkering down, then that's not
glaring at you.
That's not right.
Right.
You know, litter box behaviors. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we're talking about that later, kind of some of the signs at home.
Sure. Yes.
Or we can talk about it now if you want.
Well, we can both. How's that sound?
Let's do it. So, for cats, you know, can they jump up onto surfaces that they normally would? You know, can they jump on the bed? Can they jump up onto the counter if they're allowed to? Can they, you know, can they do what they normally
Let's just say
do?
You have a cat that will jump 6 feet through the air to land on your shoulders.
Uh-huh. Like Gretchen does.
Like my cat does.
Who's in her lap right now. He's being very cute.
Yeah. I mean, I will know something's wrong with this cat the day he stops being willing to jump to my shoulders from literally any other surface in my house.
Absolutely.
And you know, and it's like, okay, well, he feels mm-hmm. fine.
Litter pan, changes in litter pan behaviors mm-hmm. in older cats in mm-hmm. particular.
They can't step in.
They can't step into the box. It's hard to do it.
They won't crouch.
They can't hunker down. I keep talking about hunkering, but
yeah.
you know, they can't really crouch down and have a bowel movement as mm-hmm. easily, so they may become constipated.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have the litter box on different floor of their house.
Yep.
And the cat's like, I don't need to go downstairs to poop
when
I can do it right
corner.
Here. Yeah. You know, and so making, we'll talk more about accommodations, but
yeah.
But those are signs that you don't necessarily go, oh, my cat's in pain.
Right.
Because the cat's not saying anything.
No.
You know, and with dogs, you know, people come in all the time saying he doesn't hurt. And I'm looking at them and I'm seeing physical manifestations. Right. They're holding their feet closer together. They're having a shorter gait when they're walking around.
Or they're stiff-legged.
Really stiff-legged.
Yes.
Or they're slow sitting down. They're really slow and have an effort getting
up. Or they whine when they have a bowel movement.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like that's...
Or they don't complete the bowel movement.
Right.
They have to just take, you know, like stand up and take a break or something instead of being able to hold that position.
Yes, because it hurts.
You know, they can't jump up into the car any longer.
Right.
And, or in the case, like when I had my dog, it took him longer to recover after I took him for a walk.
Yeah.
He wanted to go. He'd love to go.
Right.
But then the day after the walk, he was wiped out.
Right.
And it used to be he was ready to go again the next day. And so, you know, It just the recovery time for normal things. So again, they don't, you know, people say, well, he's not crying, so he must not be in pain. Yeah. Or I saw a dog yesterday, has a knee injury. You know, well, I don't think it hurts because she's just holding the leg up all the time. Well,
it hurts to put it down.
It hurts to put it down. So she doesn't do it.
Probably hurts.
You know, but I mean that's, we get that a lot. And
it's not, you know, I mean, like people just don't know.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, they're not bad people for not knowing. And that's
right,
the thing. It's like,
right.
you know, people, I had a person complained to me one time. This is kind of off subject, but it's the same concept. She was complaining because her dog was peeing in the house. And I was like, well, how often do you let him out? She's like, well, twice a day. And I was like, well, you pee more than twice a day, right?
Yeah.
And she's like, well, yeah. And I was like, your dog's bladder is smaller than yours. Mm-hmm. Let the poor guy out and you'd be amazed at how much reduction in accidents you see. And that's the thing. It just had not occurred to her.
Yeah. That's why we're here.
That's why we're having this conversation.
both listeners and in the office.
Exactly.
You know, with education and just knowing and what you're looking at.
Right, and it's not about like shaming a person for not having recognized the pain. No. It's that we have the training to recognize it.
Yeah.
And most
people my job
don't.
Is to recognize and to help.
Exactly.
And so that's what we try to do.
Exactly.
And how do we help them, Gretchen?
Well,
I guess you're going to ask me that.
That's exactly what I was going to do. So one of the things that we use, Dr. P, are medications.
Yes.
We do have drugs available for pain. Let's talk about a couple of types of medications that we use, and then maybe just a few examples across species that we use for both.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, one of the first ones that come to mind are NSAIDs, our non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
Yes.
What are some cat NSAIDs and dog NSAIDs?
So, starting with human NSAIDs, which you should not give to your pet.
Yeah, definitely don't.
So don't give your pet aspirin. Don't give your pet Advil. Don't give your pet Aleve.
Definitely not.
Tylenol only under the supervision of your veterinarian.
Yeah.
And never, ever, ever give Tylenol to your cat.
Right.
It will kill your cat.
Yes.
They cannot metabolize it, and it does horrible things. So never give Tylenol to your cat.
Just don't.
And ask us before you give it to your dog.
Right.
So, that said, there are, and again, over my career, I've seen the development of more and more sophisticated and relatively safe non-steroidals that reduce the risk of stomach ulceration, reduce the risk of kidney damage, which is another...
it's a big one.
Real big thing. And... you know, dose related and something we have to be careful about.
Yeah.
And if there's reduced kidney function, we have to be really cautious about using NSAIDs. But for the average dog or cat, cats are a lot more sensitive to NSAIDs. We don't have a lot of options for them.
No, I mean, I can think of the one.
Yeah.
Which is meloxicam,
Medicam. Well, there's two, actually.
Okay,
there's
well,
one,
good.
Onsior,
that's right. I forgot about that.
Onsior is actually developed just for cats. But it's only approved for short-term use.
Mm-hmm.
Meloxicam is a black box by the FDA because, unfortunately, the United States dosing was too high. It was wrecking cats' kidneys. So we won't really touch on that too much. But we don't have a whole lot of options. So we can't give them Tylenol. We can't give them...
No Advil, really, no aspirin.
Yeah, you know, so we're pretty limited on NSAIDs as well.
Mm-hmm.
But dogs are great because dogs, we have a ton of NSAIDs that we can use.
Yes. And they keep getting better and better.
They do.
And just to touch on cats for one second real quickly, if you have a cat that is having a procedure done and it needs short-term NSAIDs, well, Onsior.
Oh, yeah,
it's
absolutely
a great choice. And, you know, honestly, the reason I didn't think of it is because that's one that came along during my years off.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I wasn't there when it got introduced, and I didn't have a cat that needed it.
Yeah,
and
it's very helpful.
And it's great.
You know, if I see a cat with an injury, you know, and treating acute pain, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's a teeny tiny chewable tablet that the cat will actually maybe not think is poison.
Right.
And that you can get into them. So,
But dogs.
Dogs.
Let's talk dogs.
Yes, let's talk dogs because, you know, dogs have arthritis a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, especially big dogs, they have more trouble with it. So NSAIDs are really the baseline of
where you start.
And so one question that we get a lot is, you know, do I keep him on something all the time when he's fine most of the time, but
then
once in a while,
yeah,
you know, if we go for a longer walk, then he's stiff, or, you know, he plays, or he's chasing squirrels, or, you know, whatever the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it better for me to not have him on something all the time? And in some cases, it's fine to not have him on something all the time.
Right.
If it's really intermittent, you know, flare-ups, and they're functionally okay. But for the dogs who are stiff all the time, who every day cannot get up in the morning, who are having trouble with stairs, who are walking with a short gait or having their legs close together, or when they run, they're sort of bunny hopping instead of really stretching out.
Yeah, they're not taking strides. They're bouncing, more or less.
Yeah. Those dogs really do benefit from daily therapy.
And that's honestly where having somebody else look at your pet and ask you those questions, because maybe it didn't occur to you, like, oh, he is going slow up the stairs, or oh, she does limp after a walk. And it's like, oh, well, maybe it's time.
The other thing that benefits dogs, and even those ones that just are okay and accept when they go to the dog park or, you know, have a big long hike, is to treat preemptively.
Right.
To treat pain before it happens.
Yep.
Because the chemical pathways that occur with pain and the inflammatory chemicals within the joint, the whole nerve system that gets activated, going from the joint to the spine to the brain,
right,
all of that gets ramped up, and then trying to pull back from that is a lot harder than keeping it
stopping
from getting there in the first place.
And again, this is not the same thing, but it's the same concept. This is why we use pain meds before we do surgery.
Exactly.
We use preoperative pain meds so that those signals don't get sent from the start.
Yeah.
And so...
so they're not waking up going, ow!
Right.
And then we're treating that. They're waking up, you know...
what happened?
Just, what? Yeah.
Who are you? So, where am I?
And again, through my career, seeing the difference in post-operative recovery and successful recovery from complicated procedures,
yes,
for example, is... it's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing what the evolution of pain management has been, from pain is good to pain is really bad.
Yeah, we don't want it.
It's really bad. Inflammation begets more inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And
that might be the thing that leads to that mysterious maladaptive pain.
Exactly.
That we can't really explain so much as we just know that it... I mean, they know how it happens, but it's just like, well, what thing caused that switch to flip?
Yeah.
So.
And sometimes it's just that everything gets turned up
in
your whole
nervous
system and the brain and the spinal cord and all those things. And even though the original source is gone, the power has turned on and it cannot be turned back off again.
Exactly.
And so if we can keep it from getting turned on in the first place,
right,
then we have a lot better chance of avoiding that type of maladaptive pain situation.
Okay. And so without recommending one or the other, because we use a lot of different NSAIDs across the board, let's just name a couple so that people know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
The first one that comes to mind is Rimadyl.
Yeah.
That's
Rimadyl,
kind of the OG.
Rimadyl, Daramax, Prevacox.
Yeah, Prevacox.
Galliprant. Medicam or Meloxicam.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the main ones.
Those are the big guns there.
Out there.
Yeah, and I mean, all of them are still widely used. Some are newer than others, but...
and some have generics, like...
yeah, carprofen.
Rimadyl has a generic, which is called carprofen.
Yep.
So we have a lot of tools in our toolbox. And some dogs will respond better to one than they will the other.
Right. And as they keep going, they keep kind of dialing in that safety margin, you know, and so they get better and better. And, you know, for some dogs, there are patients that can be on one of the older ones forever, never have a GI problem, never have a loose stool, and they're fine and their symptoms resolve. And there are other dogs who take, you know, one dose and it's like, what have you done to me?
No good. Yeah.
So, you know.
And there are people like that too.
Yes.
You know,
there are people who are just very sensitive.
We know people that cannot take, you know,
exactly.
Take Advil. I can't.
Right.
So,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
But don't give Advil to your dog.
Yeah, definitely don't.
Just to reiterate.
Yes. And now, so the other main class of drugs that we talk about with pain are opioids.
Yes. And opioids are,
they're
a
tricky.
Slippery slope.
Yep.
So opioids are, we don't tend to use opioids for chronic pain.
No. And we don't tend to dispense opioids.
No.
So,
no.
I mean, they used to dispense fentanyl patches, and that was a mistake.
Yeah.
So.
You know, everybody knows the human issues that are out there and legal issues that are out there. And so we tend to use opioids in hospital for our acute pain situations, surgery, post-surgery injuries, you know,
pancreatitis sometimes.
You know, it used to be that if a patient came in and they maybe had a broken leg, they'd been hit by a car, they had a broken leg and they came in, and the last thing we would think about is pain management. And now
the first thing we do.
First assessment is, you know, is this pet in shock or is it a life-threatening situation?
Right.
And the second thing I do is to go and draw up pain meds.
Yeah, go to the lockbox, get some good pain meds.
Yes.
Get them feeling a little bit better.
And
we'll
the technicians
down.
Will glare at me until I do that.
Right, yeah, we'll give her the stink eye until it happens.
So, but they don't have to glare at me too much.
Right.
You know, but it helps with the assessment. It helps us to be able to take x-rays. It helps the patient be in less shock.
And honestly, a patient that is less painful, one of the things that travels with opioids in many cases, not every single one, but is a little bit of sedation.
Yes.
And so they're less painful, which helps them be calm, and they're a teeny bit sedate. Mm-hmm. And so that helps us take x-rays with a dog that's not screaming. You know, and we don't want our patients to be in pain. I do not like to take x-rays on a painful patient anytime.
Right.
You know? And so a little bit of drugs can help.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if we can give something that has multiple benefits, then so much the better.
Right. And if they have, like, a serious injury and they're having difficulty breathing, either because of the injury or the pain, if you can take care of the pain, suddenly they're breathing easier. You can improve their outcome.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, that goes back to the shock you were talking about.
Get
them calmed down a little bit and get their system to reset just a teeny bit so you can figure out what's wrong and treat it.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, limited use. I mean, sometimes we have patients who have, for example, we had a kitty that had a cancer that was really only responsive to an opioid. And we use that with some other modes that we're going to talk about.
Right.
But, you know, in that case, we were just trying to keep him palliated and comfortable.
Yeah. And that's okay.
Yeah, you know, we do what we got to do.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know. That's,
so we're not, you know, it's not, we're not limited,
and,
but.
And that's the thing. Like, if treating pain will help a patient just want to eat.
Yeah.
Especially a cat.
Yeah.
You know, like. If it will help a cat want to eat, and then by eating, everything else feels a little bit better, well, then you have greatly improved their quality of life.
Absolutely, and that's what it's all about.
Exactly.
But we're not handing out, you know, Oxy to everybody.
No, we don't have that, for the record.
We do not.
And we actually, we use far fewer of the, like, the heavy hitters than even was common back when I started, and I don't even mean at North Asheville. Like, back when I started, also I was working at a surgery hospital, so we were doling out fentanyl like it was candy back then. It was a long time ago. It was a different state. Everything was different.
Yeah.
But, and we were doing, like, big time surgeries. But we have found that you can dial back those heavy hitters a lot and just use, like, they talk about multimodal pain control. That's a whole other thing that we don't necessarily need to go into, but it's when you use a little bit of a lot of things.
Yeah. I mean, that
and you get the best of,
and even with chronic pain and arthritis pain, you know, really the concept of multimodal pain management has really come to the forefront.
Yes.
As we have more options and as we understand pain better. So again, in this last 20, 25 years,
it's been good.
It's not just throw this drug and more and more and more of it.
Right.
It is, we start with our NSAID as the bottom of the pyramid. And then, so what if the NSAID doesn't work anymore?
Right.
We can try a different NSAID, or if they don't tolerate it, we can try a different NSAID. And then if we need to stack something else on the pyramid, often we'll use nutraceuticals like glucosamine and chondroitin supplements.
Mm-hmm.
Fatty acid supplements can be beneficial. Products with greenlit muscle in particular are helpful. We look at weight management because overweight animals
take the strain off those joints
are a lot worse off, you know, with the joint pain. So we have to look at good nutrition.
Yeah.
And so that's a big foundation of what we do. And then in terms of adding more drugs, Gretchen mentioned tramadol, which we really don't use much anymore because it just
doesn't work.
The human model,
it doesn't apply to
dogs. Animals, yeah. We really are not the same.
No, as it turns out.
Yeah, how about that?
We may joke that I am a Jack Russell Terrier, but I am in fact not.
only in personality. But exactly. Anyway, so we use other drugs. Gabapentin has really come to the forefront as an adjunctive pain controller. It's not controlled yet. It may become controlled, and it maybe is in some places, but... But it's good.
It is good stuff for both species, even. Yeah. It can help cats who are terrified, for one thing.
Yes.
And it can help dogs in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. And we use it for cats for pain, because, mm-hmm. again, it's mm-hmm. something that is safe for them. It doesn't wreck their kidneys. We can adjust the dosage to where it's not too sedating, but it still gives them good pain control.
Right.
It works at the level of more than nerve level and
it's
spinal
it's
cord.
It's for neurogenic pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's great.
So, if you look at the anti-inflammatories, they work at really the level of the joint itself or the or the location
the injury
of the
itself.
Injury.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, so you're trying to reduce that. But if you can block different pathways and different parts of the pain mechanism, then you have a lot better chance of success.
Yeah.
If you just keep piling on to one place, but the pain is actually now, coming up from the spine or the nerves or wherever, then you're not going to be as successful.
Exactly.
And that's been another huge part of the evolution. It's not just that we understand to treat, but how to treat.
Right. Yes, because we understand the whole pathway a mm-hmm. little bit better. And I say a little bit better, I mean, we really have made great strides, but there's still so much more that if we could just get cats and dogs talking or get their nervous system
just for a
to
minute.
Explain.
Just for a
just,
minute.
Just be like, hey, what's happening? Okay, and then there's two more quickies that I want to mention. Occasionally, don't frequently use steroids.
Yeah, corticosteroids are a potent anti-inflammatory.
Mm-hmm. But they cause there's a lot that travels with that steroid.
They have a lot of side effects. And when you're giving anti-inflammatory doses of steroids, especially to dogs,
mm-hmm.
cats are much more tolerant to steroids. And I actually use steroids quite a bit for chronic pain in cats.
Little lap lions.
Because they just don't have the issues with it.
Right.
An overweight cat, if I'm using a lot of steroids, can become diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot safer for them, and particularly in a hospice type situation.
Well, and also we don't have the NSAID options for cats.
And we don't have as many NSAID options.
So your hands are a little bit tight in that respect.
Yeah, I've got to do what I can do.
Exactly.
So, but for dogs, what we tend to see is they tend to have greatly increased thirst. They have mm-hmm. to urinate more. Often they're hungrier, they're panting, a little bit more anxious.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I take steroids, if I take prednisone, I am all those things. I don't sleep.
You get a little keyed up.
Oh, my gosh.
And it can cause, I spoke with Dr. Lovelace about endocrine disorders. Long-term steroid use can cause problems with your adrenal glands.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Plankenhorn is noticing that my cat sucks his own tail, and it looks like a stinger.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
He's more compulsive with that.
Yes.
Anyway.
But, that's a self-soothing thing. I don't know if it's for pain or what, but that's what he does.
Yeah, it just makes him happy.
Exactly.
So chronic steroid use, if you stop cold turkey,
it's a problem.
Then you've suppressed the adrenal function, mm-hmm. and so you can really cause a lot of problems, which you've already talked about.
Right, but luckily for cats, that's less of an issue.
It really
is. They tolerate stuff much better.
Yeah, so so with dogs, we use steroids sometimes.
Not a lot.
Not a lot, and more for acute pain
mm-hmm.
than for chronic pain.
Mm-hmm. And there might be a reason that we can't use an NSAID for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And hit them with some steroids and then go from there.
Again, my patient that has the cancer and the arthritis, he's getting steroids as part of his treatment to help manage both.
Yep. And so you're not going to be giving NSAIDs. That's a whole thing we're not going to go into, but they don't work together.
They do not play well together.
No.
Gabapentin does play well with everything else.
Gabapentin's wonderful.
Which makes it really nice to be able to add in.
Yes. And then finally, the one thing I'm thinking of, because I had two dogs that had back problems, is occasionally we use muscle relaxers. In dogs that have disc disease specifically, you can put them on a muscle relaxer, and sometimes that will take them from so painful they cannot walk, or their nerves are so fried and everything is so tense they can't walk, everything's spasmed. You put them on a muscle relaxer, and it does not solve the problem, but they get some use back.
Right.
And that helps.
It doesn't treat pain.
No.
But it can treat one of the sources of pain.
Exactly.
And it's generally not that great by itself, but nope. Certainly as an adjunct.
No.
And then there's non-pharmacological interventions.
Exactly. And that's actually what I was going to go to next, is let's talk about a couple of what those are.
Yeah. So, There are a lot of non-drug therapies that mm-hmm. can be helpful to control pain. One is cold laser therapy, acupuncture. We talked about warmth. You certainly don't want to put a hot heating pad on your dog and walk away
no.
and expect them to not get burned. You have to be really careful with heat therapy. I don't really understand how it works. There's a product called the Assisi Loop.
I have one.
That
yeah.
It does some...
It's pulsed...
What's it supposed to do? Yeah.
This is a
I
thing.
Don't use it
And
much.
The thing is, it doesn't work for every condition or every patient. But when it works, it can be really helpful. And it's pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. So it's PEMFT. And it's basically, they call it an NPED. So as opposed to an NSAID, it's non-pharmaceutical anti-inflammatory device.
Okay.
As opposed to non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. And the way it works is there's just, it's what it sounds like. It's pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. And it's a loop, like as it's called, the Assisi loop. And within that loop, there's this little teeny tiny electromagnetic field, and it can really help reduce inflammation, which is a source of pain, and just kind of cause a general like a relaxation. So one of my dogs that had back problems, we could put the loop on him if he were like acutely, like when he turned wrong and he tweaked something, we could put the loop on him and just help him relax a little bit. And that's really what it does. And it can help reduce.
Mm.
I've seen it work, where it can help reduce swelling and things like that. So it can help some of the symptoms of pain. They are a very expensive prescription device.
Yes.
And I don't believe we dispense them at the animal hospital. But I got them from a veterinary acupuncturist. And it
yeah.
helped my dog, but it certainly does not help every dog or cat. They have other things. They have like a cat bed for cats with arthritis.
Yeah.
And people get varying degrees of success. It's, you know, if you want to try it, in my not doctor opinion, it's worth trying if you've got the money and you got somebody who can prescribe it to your pet. Because again, it is also a prescription device. You know, it can be great. It worked for my dog, but it definitely won't work for every single dog.
Yeah. And but, that's the thing with all of this stuff, you know,
yeah.
is everybody's different. And, so there really is a lot of trial and error.
Right.
You know? So if you go in with the mindset of, why can't my vet fix my dog's pain? Or why can't my vet fix my cat's pain?
Mm-hmm.
That's
why.
It's kind of not a fair question. Because
right.
because every animal is different and every pain is different.
Right.
So, but anyway, so a CC loop, laser,
mm-hmm.
acupuncture,
Physical therapy.
We have a couple of wonderful rehab
yeah.
Hospitals
yeah.
in
and
town.
Sometimes even just helping rebuild muscle loss from, you know, various... I apologize. It sounds like... I don't know if our listeners can hear this, but if it sounds like there's a herd of elephants upstairs in my house, technically there are not any elephants.
It's her husband. And dogs.
So, yeah.
Those are the elephants. Anyways. So,
Yeah, so physically, like, yeah. you know, sometimes helping to rebuild muscle that has been atrophied
mm-hmm.
can help because it can, you know, it can help improve their gait. It can help with various
increase
things.
Increase blood flow to the joints.
Exactly. Increase
so.
Blood flow and improve flexibility and that kind of thing. Range of motion, things like that. So physical therapy can be helpful. Laser therapy, you mentioned
yeah.
we have a cold laser at the animal hospital that we use.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Yeah, it is.
And,
the other thing that I try not to forget about is a product called Adequan. And this is a PS GAG, which is a polysulfated glycosaminoglycan.
Exactly.
Which is one of the...
Just, it's thank so, you. So obvious. Hey,
you got to be fancy with the whole SEC loop thing. Exactly. So, you know. So what Adequan does is the polyglycosaminoglycan PS GAG is one of the proteins that's present in the joint fluid and in the cartilage. Mm-hmm. And my best analogy is that I was watching sports of some sort, and an ad for a motor oil treatment came on. Mm-hmm. And it talked about how it reduced the breakdown of the
molecules. Yeah.
It reduced engine breakdown, and it helped to improve the viscosity of the oil.
Right.
And I thought, that is exactly what Adequan does. Mm-hmm. It improves the viscosity of the joint fluid, the bathes the fluid, mm-hmm. because when breakdown products and little bits of molecular cartilage get right. floating around in the fluid, it doesn't lubricate as well.
Right.
So if we can repair the cartilage to the extent that we can, and we can thicken up the joint fluid, then we have a smoother, more functional joint.
Right. And if you think of the cartilage as being like kind of like the insole in your shoe, it's like a cushion that keeps your joints from having bone on bone contact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the better your cushion is there, and the healthier that is, because the joint fluid is doing its job. Mm-hmm. And that's what Adequan helps with.
It does. And you know, if an animal has really advanced arthritis, mm-hmm. you know, if it's already bone on bone and just a grungy joint, then there's only so much that Adequan can do.
Right.
But if we're in the earlier stages of arthritis, I've got a patient with hip dysplasia that we've started on Adequan just to try to protect her joints as much as possible.
Slow it down.
So she doesn't get as bad of arthritis right. later on down the line.
Yeah.
So, and that is also a prescription product. It's an injection mm-hmm. that we teach owners how to do at home. Usually we don't have to have the dog or cat come in.
Right. Some people would prefer for us to do it, and that's fine.
Some people are weird about, unhappy about getting injections at home.
Well, yeah, that
or the
they
pet
don't,
won't let them.
Yes, there's that, or they don't want to be the one to do it to their
bad
pet.
Guy.
Yeah, they don't want to be the bad guy. They'd rather pay me to do it.
We're always like, the bad guys, so, you
right.
know.
we can't
but all for good.
Yeah.
So it's given twice a week for 4 weeks, and then it's kind of as needed after that. Mm-hmm. And it can make a big difference.
Yep.
So, you know, if your pet is having chronic pain issues, ask your vet about that.
Yeah. And I mean, it really is a good drug, and it's, you know, like the maintenance, once you achieve maintenance on it, it's, mm-hmm. it's not that
it's
tricky.
Easy. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And let's talk, I feel like we've talked about a bunch of those things. Let's talk about some basic comfort measures.
Yeah.
That people can provide for their pets at home. I'm thinking like, you know, a nice cozy place for your cat to curl up.
Mm-hmm.
That's
warm, soft beds.
Warm, soft beds. Yep.
And, you know, we hear stories all the time. I got my dog this wonderful bed.
He'd
I
rather
put it down,
sleep on
and
the...
he sleeps next to it on the concrete floor.
Right.
You know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Right.
So we do the best that we can, right? But you know, try to provide a comfortable place. Cats are a little bit more willing to accept
right.
comfort
any,
measures.
Any soft, warm place for a cat will do in most cases.
They're, you know, they're a little more hedonistic.
Yes. so. They are. But, I mean, you know, honestly, like, my daughter has, like, this nice cozy bed. It's got zillions of blankets and stuffies on it. And our cat lives to go curl up in her bed.
Oh, sure.
He's a
yeah.
young cat, but it's a soft, warm place. And that's his favorite place.
Absolutely.
I've noticed also in some cases, like I had a dog that as she got older, she was like a lot more sensitive to being warm. And so when she was young and not in pain, she would curl up on me. She never didn't want to be touching me. And then, you know, as she got older, she would actually give herself a little more distance, and it wasn't terrible. It was just, it got like, I think she was uncomfortably warm. You know, she wanted her own soft place mm-hmm. and not to be sharing my body heat with hers and all of that kind of thing. And so it's just, you know.
I think also being sensitive to the fact that, like, if you have multiple pets and you have a young one and you have an older one that's arthritic and stuff, The young one may not understand to hold back.
Totally.
And so, you know, we can see older pets become crankier.
Yes. Because they're getting harassed.
They're getting harassed and they're anticipating pain or they're experiencing pain.
They're getting, like,
you know, it's
bowled
like,
over.
Last time, kid, you jumped on me and it hurt.
Right, it hurt
and
for
so
days.
So just back off. You know, just don't jump on me anymore.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, you may see that kind of behavior change and you may need to give your older pet some space.
Yes, and that actually holds true for small children and older pets.
Exactly.
You
true.
Know,
yeah.
I had an older dog that got grumpy, and when my daughter was little, we just had to keep them apart because she would intentionally fall on him. She's not a bad kid. He wasn't a bad dog. It was just a bad combination.
Yeah.
You know?
And even adults, you know, I mean, if you used to be able to pick your, whatever, your little dog or your cat
yes.
up a certain way, and then now they won't let you do it that way, maybe it's uncomfortable for them.
Right.
Maybe just don't do that anymore. Other home accommodations, we talked about beds,
ramps.
There are ramps to get in the car. There are ramps to get up onto, to use for stairs. There are little steps that you can do to let your little dog or your big dog or
onto
your cat
the bed
up
easier.
Onto the bed.
Yep. I remember before those even existed, I remember when I was growing up, my mom made little steps for their elderly cat to get to the bed. And the cat, she needed a tutorial.
Yeah.
But as soon as she learned, that's what she used. And it was great.
Yeah.
So.
And then there's the ones that they jump up next to the, you know, they look at the steps and then they jump
still
up
jump.
On the bed next to it. But,
right.
you know, anyway.
That's cats.
Once again. So what else?
Moving the litter box.
Moving the litter box. We talked about, you know, trying to have the litter box on the same level that your cat spends the most time. And if you need to have a litter box on all the levels of the house.
That's a thing.
So be it, you know.
Right.
And my feeling is, you know, people tell me, and I have thought the same. One of my cats decided that the den where I watch TV was a great place to start peeing. And I didn't want a litter box in that location, but I didn't want him peeing on the floor. So now I have a litter box there.
Yeah. It's,
you know,
you know,
so if you look at, if you weigh the, you know, I don't want a litter box in my living room. Yeah. But do you want cat pee in your living room?
Because
those are your choices.
Exactly. And also, I mean, there are litter boxes that have a low threshold and some cats can, they can no, I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, floor level threshold, just not a giant one. Just make it so the cat can easily step into it.
Some of the covered boxes, they really have to work to get into the box.
Yeah.
They want more space. They can't get as small to be able to go to the bathroom. So make sure that there's plenty of headroom. The best suggestion, you know, just to do at home is to get a big storage bin and cut a nice roomy opening into it. Have it deep enough to where the cat's not flinging litter all over the place.
Right.
But big enough to where the cat has plenty of room to walk around, turn around. And actually that goes for even younger cats.
Yes.
Make sure they have plenty of space in their litter box.
Make it a nice bathroom.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, nice,
you know, we all like a nice bathroom.
Exactly.
So, so that's, you know, an important accommodation. Just anything you can think of. You know, if your pet's having trouble doing something,
talk to your vet.
Talk to your vet.
And make it easier.
You know, for dogs that are more lame or have more mobility issues in the back end, there's some wonderful slings. And,
right. There are help them up harnesses where you
help
can literally help them up.
I love this thing.
Yeah.
It's got handles on the front and back. It's great.
Yep. They're excellent. And it's nice that we have all these tools now that even, you know, like I've been in the field for a while now, but so many things have come along.
Yeah.
Even just since I started.
So this is a case where you can go on the internet.
Yes. Go find a thing that will help your pet. And also, even if your pet is having pain, I think the take-home message, or if you think they might be having pain, is talk to your vet.
Absolutely. Because we're here
to
help.
Your vet.
You know, we can bring a lot of ideas to the table that will be safe and hopefully effective for your pet.
Right, and it doesn't have to be an expensive surgery or anything like that.
No.
Sometimes there's a real, like, low barrier to entry to help treat the pain.
Yeah.
It's really straightforward.
Or prevent it. You know,
yeah, better case scenario.
Better to prevent than to wait until it's really, really bad and then try to treat.
Exactly. All right, well, thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Plankenhorn.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Again, this podcast is intended for educational purposes only, and it is specifically intended for clients of the Animal Hospital of North Asheville. If today's episode has contradicted information given to you by your veterinarian, please adhere to your practice's advice and policies. This brings us to the end of the episode. If you aren't already, we'd love it if you'd stay connected with us on social media. Thank you for listening, and until next time, may your life be full of puppy love and kitten kisses.